At Breaking the Glass Slipper, we believe it is important to have conversations about women and issues of intersectional feminism within science fiction, fantasy, and horror. To continue to do so, we need your help. Please consider supporting us on Patreon. Join the conversation by following us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram.
Hello, and welcome to Breaking the Glass Slipper. I'm Charlotte Bond.
And I'm Megan Lee.
Religion has been part of our society for centuries. Is it any wonder, then, that it can make up a large part of our fiction? From C.S. Lewis's allegorical Narnia series, to Anna Smith Sparks' Empire of Dust trilogy and the Loki books by Joanne Harris. But with so many religions the world over, just what kind of pantheons are making it into the books we read? What kind of religious customs are authors creating in their fictional world? And to what purpose? What does the portrayal of religion in our fiction tell us about our own society? The portrayal of religion is also tied up with the history and traditions of the world. This is how we've always done it, can be antithetical to the hero and his or her journey and destiny. Religion, with its rites, rituals, and reliance on ancient entities, can be part of why we do it, how we've always done it. Joining us for this episode to share his perspective on religion, tradition, and history in fantasy is Andrew Knighton, author of the exceptional novella Ashes of the Ancestors, published by Luna Press. Thank you for joining us, Andrew. Tell our listeners a little bit about yourself and your work.
Hi, my name's Andrew Knighton. I am a freelance writer by trade and an author in the gaps between that. I've written comics for Top Cow and Commando. I've written, last count, 70-ish published short stories over a protracted span of time, and a couple of novellas, Silver and Gold, which is about a magical craftsperson making jewellery, and Ashes of the Ancestors, most recently last year, which came out from Luna Press, as Charlotte said, and is currently on the shortlist for the Subjective Chaos Kind of Award, which I was very excited about. Yeah, I also have some novels coming out next year, but that's like off in the future sometime. So.
Well, I reread Ashes last night in preparation for this, and I've forgotten just how amazing it was. So I'm really looking forward to talking to you about
it. That means a lot.
So, first question. I was thinking about the fact that when you have fantasy, you quite often have old established colonies compared to maybe science fiction where you go out and you establish your colony. So in science fiction, you're maybe creating your rites and rituals and history, whereas in fantasy, you already have strong elements of history and tradition within your society. You've got ancient rites that performed, you've got destinies that were foretold, and you've got very set roles for men and women. So I wondered what you thought a secondary fantasy world would look like if it took a sort of a leaf out of the sci-fi book and charted the adventures of a shiny new civilization. Do you think it would still work as a fantasy, or would a crucial element be lost and it'd be sci-fi fantasy?
So, I mean, I think you could do that. You can show the roots of a civilization in lots of different contexts. The interesting one from outside of sci-fi and fantasy, but for historical fiction, is the TV series Deadwood, which was originally conceptualized as they wanted to explore the concept of the birth of a civilization. So they put it out on the frontier in the American West. But what even that story shows is that actually you never really get a shiny new start. We're always shaped by our history and by what comes before. So if you write a story where you try to wipe that away, where you try to completely ignore it, it would seem flat and unreal. You know, people always bring the baggage from wherever they've come from. So those stories about new civilizations can actually be a really interesting way of exploring history, because they show how the rules and the norms get laid down for the future when people have got fewer constraints and when they're a bit more free to reinvent their relationship with the past. But that relationship to the past is still there. You're just then looking at what do they keep, what do they abandon? Do they, to take the example you were talking about there, do they keep old gender roles? Do they ditch them? Do they invent new ones? How do they relate to the other people they come up against? The idea of like actually being able to start from scratch without any of that history, that tradition, those roots that we all have, because, you know, as people, we exist through history, through our own history, through changing over time. Every society does as well. So the idea of what you'd do if you didn't have those roots at all, it's kind of an interesting thought experiment. It would be a very fantastical thing to explore in itself, because that's so alien to anything about how we live. I'm actually now kind of going, oh, I was looking for a weird story idea to write. Maybe that's it. People who have no past.
Well, then I clearly need to be named as one of the characters of the
Be careful. I've done a lot of that, particularly with the Commando comics writing. Several of my friends have met quite grisly ends over the course of fictional versions of World War II. So, yeah.
So I found the detail that you had in Ashes of the Ancestors to be unbelievably thorough. It was like it was a civilization right there on the page, and particularly because we obviously had a religious setting and all the rites and customs and things like that. So how did you go about creating a whole world in such a small book? Did you look at things that exist in history and how current abbeys are run, or did you just make it up as you went along?
It was kind of taking a lot of little bits and pieces of things I've seen. I have this document that is essentially a mulch. It's where I put all the snippets of things that I pick up over the years, that things I see in books, museums, whatever, and dump them into there so that whenever I'm looking for new projects, I can go and search it for stuff on that theme. And there are a few bits and pieces of details in there that I picked out, things about how it is to be in an abbey, that kind of thing. But really, the starting point for the world building, and in fact, for the whole thing, for the whole story, was thinking about tradition. I wanted to look at this idea of how tradition works, how it shapes us, because that's really interesting to me. I've worked for a long time with history. I do a lot of history writing, both fictional and non-fiction. And as someone who is quite reforming in their social and political views, I find that there is a kind of almost, not exactly a clash there, but there is a contrast there between how I view that and the way that a lot of people, the reasons why they're interested in history, often actually they're interested in clinging to the past, in trying to keep things the same. So I wanted to get into that. That was the starting point more than the actual religion, was I wanted to get into that tension, this double-edged thing of tradition as something that's very useful, but if you get too tied into it, it can hold you back. Religion was just a natural fit for that to me, because there's so much tradition woven into it. And I think I had, so having got that in my head, you know, that was the theme I wanted to play with. I then went and looked in this, you know, I found the religion section in my big old document full of random notes, and I skimmed through it looking for stuff on religion or stuff on tradition. And I found this idea that I think it came from a history book I'd written. Sorry, not written, one I'd read. And they talked about this haunted monastery. This was, I think, in 15th or 16th century Italy. And I thought, well, what if the monastery was just full of ghosts? Brilliant. And so I remembered this. And I was like, okay, yes, that's it. Because then they can be the tradition. They can be there and people can be taking pilgrimages to them and they can do that. And then the physicality of it, because the abbey in the story is based on this huge stone pillar. But that was actually inspired by a real place. There's a place in Greece called Meteora, which is, it's this strange rock formation, which has created these very, very tall natural pillars of stone. And at some point in the early church, I can't remember quite at what point, they started building monasteries on top of these pillars, because it was a way for the monks to get away from the temptations and distractions of civilization and live these very thoughtful, faithful lives, you know. So they built these monasteries, most of which have since fallen down because those rock pillars eroded. They are, you just look it up, look for Meteora on the internet, see pictures of it. It's quite amazing. Most of these rock pillars have eroded and they've fallen away. And there's about five or six of these monasteries left. And I went to see them when I was 17. And it's one of those memories that is just going to live with me forever. It is absolutely breathtaking and absolutely bewildering. And as someone who is not very good with heights, going up to going around these things up the top of these hundreds of feet high pillars, also kind of terrifying. And so then when I was like, well, okay, I want this monastery full of ghosts. What should it look like? I was like, well, of course it's going to be on top of this big rock pillar, blah, blah, blah. And I knew I wanted it to be, if we were dealing with how we deal with the past and break from tradition or don't break from tradition and move forward as a society, then I was also interested in exploring where we're at the moment, where we're facing an environmental crisis and where our habits and our inability to break out of those habits is kind of driving us into a very bad place. And so that then led to this idea that, okay, well, what about if the whole empire around them is collapsing, the environment they're living in is degrading, the society is falling apart? That gives you lots of conflict, but it also drives discussion of tradition, because you're then saying, well, do we cling to these things? Are these precedents we have, are these habits we have, these ways of working, are they the only thing that's keeping us going in these difficult times, or are they the thing that's causing these difficult times? So it kind of puts the conflict in there. And let me just kind of spill many of my existing obsessions onto the page together.
Sounds super cheery.
Oh, everything I write is laugh a minute.
All right. Well, I think we've sort of mentioned that basically we're going to be talking about religion and so on. So
yeah,
before we get stuck into all these questions, can you just give us a little like summary? Tell us a little bit about the religions, mm-hmm. I don't know, that you invented for your novella, yeah, just so we can get kind of just understand the context a little bit.
Ashes of the Ancestors is set in this place, the Eternal Abbey, and it is at the heart of this empire. It was founded 1,000 years before by the Empress Crisania, who is now one of the ghosts there. And the religion of this empire is essentially one of ancestor worship. And the ancestors they are following are these saints, these ghosts who live in the abbey. So when somebody very important or very valuable or very prestigious dies, they get taken to the abbey, they're cremated, and then their spirit remains in the abbey and manifests through the smoke that the priests produce around the abbey using this old machinery that's all around the place and that fills the building with smoke. At the start of the novella, we've reached a point where, because of this wider degradation of the society they're living in, there's only one priest left. Magdalisa is living up there at the abbey on her own. She is the only one left who's keeping this machinery going, who's keeping the fires burning every day to provide the smoke for the ghosts to manifest and to cater to the requests and the demands of these people who've basically been preserved eternally, so that you can go and say, excuse me, I'm stuck. How does the past say I should deal with this problem? It's a great vehicle for looking at a historic change. This is going to sound like a really weird example, but if you look at the sitcom, The Vicar of Dibley, like they got so much out of one single historic change that was coming at that point in time. Like,
amazing.
The Church of England is letting women become vicars, and this is a staggering change that overturns nearly 2,000 years. Well, no, okay, it's the Church of England. That overturns like 400-500 years of tradition and 1,000 years of tradition before that. And so at the time, just the existence of that character like brings in all these questions and tensions and therefore comedy, because that's how they played it. But also now, like, we've moved on and it looks kind of mundane. It's like, well, of course the vicar's a lady.
You mentioned that your gods are sort of saintly humans who have been sort of deified. I mean, that was the thing that I loved about it. And I almost wish there was kind of like another novella that dealt with, you know, shepherds coming for the lost sheep. I kind of feel like there's a lot of war in your novel and a lot of strategy and whatever. And I feel there's like a homely kind of novel where all the shepherds come and look for their lost sheep and, you know, the blacksmith come and talk about how their iron is brittle and all this kind of stuff. Anyway. That aside, your gods were once humans who've earned the right to be deified. So I wondered, did this make them more fallible than gods who are divine from the start? And I wonder what issues this allowed you to explore that might have been closed off if you'd gone for gods who'd just always been gods.
So, I mean, I think there's almost, there's actually kind of two things there, because there's the immortality bit and there's fallibility. And fallibility is actually part of holy figures in most tradition, most religions. Infallibility is really just comes in with certain monotheisms. That concept of infallibility to me is very weird, impossible even. Even having been raised in a Christian family, that the idea that any entity could be infallible feels, alien to me. So they were never really going to be like that for me. And also, of course, what I produced isn't really a religion with gods. It's ancestor worship. It's saints, which does create a different mindset. So, you know, as soon as you've got more than one divine figure, somebody's got to be wrong some of the time. But as soon as you do that as well, they're not just an embodiment of moral right anymore. They are a way for you to try and navigate the world. There's someone who can help you or who can hinder you. And that creates conflicts, because also they're going to have different approaches. They're going to have different views of people. And you can never resolve that thing by just saying, well, following that God is right, because you've not got that one. You've not got that mosaic distinction between the right and the wrong. And then I think because they've lived before and because they've then become divine, that adds even more, though. That brings it back into the history. It lets the people's pasts shape who they are. It humanizes them. It makes these divine figures more relatable without depriving of the power that comes with divinity and of the awe that can create for the people who worship them. That sense of awe, that sense of faith, I think it was important to have some of that on the page. I didn't want this to seem like I'm being dismissive of belief. So in that weird sort of way, it's kind of grounding them while also letting them be something more than ordinary.
I'm sorry, every time you were talking about gods being infallible, I could only think about Red Dwarf with Holly saying, I'm infoolable!
Yeah.
Yes. Anyway, so in general, do you think we have moved beyond depicting sort of, you know, in quotation marks, good religions in fantasy to be those inspired by sort of the Christian tradition, the monotheism, as you mentioned, and using other religions to represent something either evil, again, in inverted commas, or simply more primitive? Or is fantasy still stuck in this old-fashioned exoticism when it comes to creating their fictional religions?
I've never felt like the fantasy I was reading had much of that old-fashioned mindset. I'm aware it's out there, and I'm aware that to some extent there are probably things where it's there and I'm missing it, and I don't notice it because I was brought up around it. But I actually think if you, depending upon where you look, you can, for decades now, I've been seeing some quite nuanced takes on this and very varied ones. In fact, even like what seems familiar and what a lot of our Western fantasy is built on, in terms of its trappings, isn't always Christian anyway. You know, there's a lot of stuff that, for example, draws on Norse folklore, but that then it does tend to absorb some sort of underlying thinking of Christianity, you know, the idea that you, as you said, that you have a right and a wrong religion, as opposed to the sort of the pre-Christian thing, say that Roman era Europe, where you wouldn't have a right religion, a wrong religion, you have my religion, your religion, and we mix them together. And it's not that this one is the truth and that one's false. It's just, we've got different guys around the place. And I mean, in fact, you even see, as Christianity spreads through Europe, people try to fit that into that mold as well. You find these crosses that have pagan symbols on them, carved all across the place, going off on a kind of a history tangent there. So yeah, but I think actually, if you look at a lot of the fantasy that features religion, there are some more interesting takes on that. Things like Song of Ice and Fire, you've got this Christian-like religion that's really just part of society. It's doing good and it's doing bad, but it's a social construct. And that's what really interests me. You know, I'm interested in religion not as something that's going to reveal the truth about that universe. I'm interested in religion as a psychological experience and as a social construct. So it's how people feel these incredibly powerful motives and feelings and connections, something greater than themselves, but then also the thing of how that changes their behavior in society, or how people use the structures built around that to far more cynical ends. And I mean, then there's other interesting approaches to dip into sci-fi. Julian May's Galactic Milieu series is in some ways basically May playing out this somewhat heretical model of Catholicism that Père-Pierre Teilhard de Chardin came up with, which is a whole kind of somewhat odd philosophical construct for which Chardin, like if he'd lived 100, 200 years earlier, he probably would have got burnt in a stake for that stuff. At the time, he was quite a respected scholar in other ways. And it was into the 20th century and the church just like, yeah, just do your thing over there. Don't talk about it too widely. We're not publishing these bits of what you think. So I think you can use it to explore, and even that, I suppose that one does fall more into discussing good and evil, but it doesn't do it in that our way is good, your way is bad way. That one is exploring concepts of good and evil within Christianity. And that is part of the thing. I'd say most people these days, when they're writing religion into fantasy, don't treat a religion as just a good or just an evil. They try to look for something either more complex or more cynical, which can be the same thing, but isn't always. But then there's a lot of Christian thinking still gets centered, even when you're apparently challenging and deconstructing some of those Christian ideas. Garth Ennis and Steve Dillon's Preacher comics are like a classic example of this. In those comics, the central character is this preacher who ends up going on a mission to get of justice against God. God is a classic patriarch. He's been doing terrible things. It is about rebellion against God as an act of good. And that sounds like it's kind of completely overturning your Christian concepts of the world. And then you look at it, you're like, well, but actually it's also reinforcing the idea that this is that Christian world. That guy did make it. These entities do exist. This dichotomy of light and darkness exists rather than the pre-Moses thing where you don't view religion that way, where it's not about this one's good and this one's right and that one's wrong. So that stuff still seeps in, and ethics of Christianity get valorized even when we create religions that don't look Christian at all. You know, ideas of prioritizing self-sacrifice over, say, self-care and group care, of, you know, dying importantly rather than living on through the hard work, the importance of the heroic individual, which very much fits that Christian tradition. So actually, it's interesting to see how it kind of slips in even when we're trying to move past it, that those ideas are just so embedded in the way of thinking.
I know what you mean. There was a lot of Christianity in my childhood, and I think I'm getting away from that in my writing simply because I've read an awful lot of other religious stories. Like one of the first things I ever really loved was my book of Myths and Legends by Anthony Horowitz. Mm-hmm. And it's still got my name and my telephone number and my address and my class in it from when I used to take it to school and read it in case I lost it. It's like, it must come back to me. So I put down all my information and everything. But obviously, like me, I presume you know a lot about different religions because you will have read up for them, not only for your other writing, but for a book like this. So I was thinking about looking at other religions as well as Christianity and Norse and things. You often find many similarities. Like, I was amazed by how similar the creation stories all are. There's an egg, or there's light and dark, or there's all these recurring themes. And if they were in fiction, we'd almost call them tropes. Mm-hmm. So I wondered what elements of real-life religion you've seen writers frequently drawing when creating imaginary religions, and whether there are any particular you wanted to either tackle or avoid in your book.
Yeah, so there are some that get used a lot, you know, these ideas of end times. You get a lot of war gods. You know, if anybody has a pantheon, there's probably going to be a war god, there's probably going to be a sun god.
I love pantheons and all the different gods that people come up with. I just have fun doodling, go, oh, what if there's a god of this sometimes?
Yeah, I was going back to university when we were at the Live Roleplay Society there. It was it had a pantheon where you could just chuck stuff in and you end up with some of the weirdest ideas. There was a god of cats. I came up with Jack, the god of all trades at one point. I used to play around with that nonsense quite a lot. So it was just like, you know, a god who's not very good at anything, but he makes you a little bit good at everything. Anyway, so, but those weren't the ones I wanted to explore in this. The stuff that I've used is more the things that we take for granted as normal, as fundamental to religion in the West, but that actually aren't. So things like the Abbey itself, having this separate space in which you conduct religion that is completely cut off from everyday life. You know, it's on top of a stone pillar. It is completely physically detached from the people it is supposedly benefiting. And you know, that is something we take for granted in religion, and that some level of physical separation and of ritual separation of people's spiritual lives and the way that shapes them being separate from their day-to-day life, that's something we actually take for granted quite a lot in our society. But it's not normal for religion. Things like hierarchy and priesthood as well. Any religion you come across in fantasy will have its priesthood. Sometimes that's the only bit of the religion you actually see. You know, somebody just wanted to write a priest character. But even in the West, Quakers, at least British Quakers and liberal Quakers within the divisions of America, they don't have a priesthood. You have elders who can guide you and provide as close as they have to leadership, but actually it's completely unhierarchical. There's no service. There's no songs. There's no structure to it. People just sit there and occasionally, and anybody can speak. So I've taken that kind of ceremony. Those are things I wanted in there. And then one that I was interested in, and again, it ties back into this thing of wanting to look at history and how we relate to the past and how we move on from it. It was basically patriarchy, not so much the gendered aspect of that. That is, you know, the fundamental aspect of it. But there's this other part that we sometimes forget to talk about when we think about patriarchy, you know, the rule of fathers, which it is that it is a small amount of elder authoritative people who are in charge. And, you know, this is the way, one of the ways in which patriarchy harms men as well, because it actually disenfranchises most of them. So while I've not kept the gendered division there, I did want to look at that, at what happens when you have an authority figure and when you make them so authoritative that it becomes almost impossible to challenge them, that becomes unthinkable. And what then happens when challenging them becomes necessary?
Without giving away too many spoilers, I did love that element of your book and who challenged and who didn't and what the outcome was. I thought there was a lovely nuanced approach to at least three different ways of challenging hierarchy. It was amazing.
Yeah, that was something that was really important to me. I have strong views on how we should relate to tradition, but I respect the attitudes that other people have and why they have those attitudes, and I understand why they have those attitudes. I absolutely did not want to write a book that seemed one-sided in that regard, that just went, here we are, burn it all down, that's obviously the answer, you know, move on. It wouldn't be very interesting, and it wouldn't be very honest, and it would kind of be insulting to a lot of people, including a lot of people I love. So I tried to show different approaches while staying true to what I think.
You mentioned that you sort of didn't necessarily look to break things down along gender lines so much. But, you know, Charlotte's noted that you've given a few of the men sort of, you know, that normally, traditionally, I should say, traditionally, not normally, traditionally in religion, men have often been given, you know, the quote unquote responsible jobs. But you have actually given a lot of those roles to women in the book. So it's the women who guard the ashes of the ancestors. You know, if you weren't necessarily wanting to really make a point of splitting things down the gender lines, why put women front and center? Not that we're complaining, but why did you do that? And when you did do that, did you find yourself having to sort of look at kind of inspirations or traditional religious tropes and things, you know, and have to tweak them in order to make that feel more real, given all the baggage that readers and so on will bring to it?
Okay, so to answer that one, I'm kind of going to go back slightly in terms of my own writing history. So I used to, by default, write a lot of male protagonists. And when I wrote women in, even with my very good raised feminist intentions to, you know, to try and put them in good positions and show an equal thing, I often gave them actually quite cliche roles. You know, if there were three characters occupying different skill sets, the woman would end up being one of the social skills. And I got called on this by beta readers, Charlotte included, on what I was doing there. And I was like, oh shit, yeah, no, you're right, I am. Okay, I've got to work harder at this. And so sometime, and I mean, we are talking over a decade ago, but I started making a conscious effort to try and get that right, as far as I'm concerned. So what I always do now when I'm approaching stories is, as far as possible, I try to have an even gender balance. So I actually went and I checked in my planning document for this, because several people have commented on that part, on the presence of the women. So there are 9 named characters in the planning document that survived into the book. And of those, 5 are women and 4 are men. So it's pretty much as evenly as I could get it split there. And I was trying to avoid the obvious cliche choices. So there are 4 prominent warrior characters in this, half of them men, half of them women. The whore, the ghost of a whore, is a man. The priests are women, but that's not because everybody in that church is women. In fact, when Magdalisa thinks back to who trained her there, that was a man. The mayor of the local town is a man. So you've got this mix. But I think we are so used to seeing, it's the classic thing, and I know you guys have discussed this before, and I've seen some really interesting conversations around this in role play contexts. We are so used to seeing an imbalance in favor of men that when you put things fairly evenly, you kind of go, that's a lot of women. So that was kind of how that came about. I didn't really feel like I had to go and look at the roles that women have played in religion, because I was just thinking about what roles the people in general play in religion. What does a priest do? What does an attendant do? How does a saint fit into a religion? How do we respect holy figures? And then I just kind of slapped that on. And I mean, maybe I should have thought more about that, because there probably are variations, but I wasn't interested in that. And this comes down to how I tend to approach world building now in general when I'm doing secondary world fantasy. I think, just to kind of slightly go off on one here, because I haven't done that enough already, I think you basically have 3 choices about how you can approach sexist hierarchies when you are world building. You can keep them in there and not challenge it. And if you do that, you end up reinforcing them and treating that as normal. And that is just like, that's the worst. I have no fucking interest in doing that at all. I do not want to my writing to contribute towards a world that maintains those differences and normalizes those differences for the generation I see coming after me, for my nieces, for other young women in my life I care about. So then the second option is, you can keep a society that has gender distinctions and has sexism, and you can challenge that within the story. And you can discuss it, and you can discuss how sexism works and how you fight it. That is really important work. And there are a lot of books I love that do that. But that is not something that I feel equipped to effectively do. I don't have the right perspective, and I have too many other weird obsessions that I want to spend my time writing about. So, I mean, this may change in the future, but right now, I don't want to spend the time in my stories fighting out the arguments around that. That then leaves option number 3. If I don't want to reinforce sexism and I don't want to have a conversation about sexism, then I just have to create a society in which it's not a thing, in which men and women and people of all genders, you know, whatever they are, non-binary, intersex, whoever's there, they are treated equally. 90% of the time now, that is my approach to my writing. And that is an assumption I have from the start. Yeah, so I'm never then thinking, what do men and women do in this society? Because they're all going to be doing it. I occasionally end up tripping over myself, because I'll be like, okay, well, like, the wizards are traditionally men, so that should be a woman to balance it out. But the warriors are traditionally men, so that should be a woman to balance it out, so blah, blah, blah. And so somewhere in the mix, the guy will get the classic guy role, but only half the time. I don't want to live in the world of Ashes into the Ancestors in as much as I don't want to live in a disintegrating empire with this weird ghost theocracy. but I do want to live in a more equal society. And so that's going in there.
I'm really thrilled with the book you've written. It's so wonderful when people you know and like write amazing books. And I would urge all our listeners to go out and buy it. And obviously to support Luna Press as well, who put out some amazing stuff.
They do. Oh my God. Like, read the other novellas that came out at the same time as this. There's some amazing things there.
There was a host of them came out all at once. So thank you so much for joining us, Andy. We're going to pop over to Patreon and ask you to talk about your holies a little bit more. But for now, thank you so much for talking to us.
Thank you very much for having me on. It's been a real pleasure.
Breaking the Glass Slipper is written and produced by Megan Lee, Charlotte Bond, and Lucy Hounsome. Please help us spread the word, subscribe, and leave a review on your preferred podcast platform. We want to hear from you. Let us know what you would like to hear on the next episode of Breaking the Glass Slipper.